It is the voice of life which calls us to come and learn.
Greetings, fellow L&D practitioners. This is Learning and Development in Transition, the podcast that presents perspectives, stories, insights, and actionable advice from the industry's top thought leaders, supporting you to add more value in your role and supporting the field of L&D to evolve toward its potential to be a powerful force for positive change in the world. I'm your host, Tom Palmer, and I'm very excited to share with you my interview with the great Charles Jennings. Charles is the co-founder of the 70-20-10 Institute, partner at the Internet Time Alliance, and someone who has kind of seen and done it all in this industry since way back. He's worked as an academic, as the chief learning officer for Thomson Reuters, which operates in over 100 countries with 45,000 employees, and as an independent consultant helping organizations use the 70-20-10 model to strengthen and align L&D with organizational performance needs. And on top of all of that, Charles is just a very kind and articulate guy with an immense amount of experience and wisdom to share. I have no doubt that anyone working in this field will benefit from what Charles has to say here. So please enjoy, take note, and learn from the one and only Charles Jennings. Hi, Charles. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's an absolute pleasure, Tom.
Charles, I'm curious. I'll start off today by asking if there's a particular experience that you'd like to share from the early days of your career or something that highlights kind of how you came into the work you do now.
I think the fundamental driver for me to come to focus on how we learn in the workplace, how we learn, what we learn through work, and how learning and working fit together really goes right back to my childhood. I grew up on a sheep station in the outback in Australia. The nearest hospital was 100 miles away. The nearest school was 100 miles away. The workmen who worked on our sheep station were self-reliant men who could turn their hands to anything. And even as a child and a teenager, I learnt that if you needed to solve a problem, you often had to go back to first principles and learn to do it by doing it, making mistakes, learning from your mistakes, practicing, learning through experience and learning through work. I mean, none of the workmen, the stockmen who worked on our family's sheep station, had any education really beyond the age of maybe 14 or 16. None had been to university and studied mechanical engineering or agronomy or anything like that. And that really set me up to understand that if you're looking to build high performance, if you're looking for high performance, you have to look beyond the formal learning structure. You have to make sure that people have every opportunity to learn as part of work, to learn from experience, to learn from practice, to learn from knowing the right people to ask the right question, to reflect on what you've done and do it differently next time. So I think that was very fundamental for me early on in my career. Then, of course, going through my university degrees and my formal education tended to take me away from that. But that basic lessons, or the lessons I learned, in the paddocks and fields and under tractors and things like that on a big sheep station, really set me up for the fact that I've spent my whole career focusing on how people learn from work as much as learn to work.
Wow, that's a fascinating background. I'm sure that gives you a pretty unique perspective on what you do. I'm curious, was there a specific time when it kind of dawned on you and you made that connection between your childhood and the insights that came up for you there and this field of L&D or workplace learning? And when did you make that connection? When did you make that decision to really commit yourself to this field?
I made the decision when the IBM PC and the Apple were produced in 1979-81. Mm-hmm. And I was working as an academic. I was asked to head up the UK government Centre for Network-Based Learning. The UK government, in an enlightened moment, set up a number of what they call centres of expertise, which mm-hmm. was really to help people understand how personal computers were going to impact other areas of work other than computing. So, there, for example, there was a computer-aided language learning center. There was one that was focused on graphic design. There were various others. And I headed up the center based on network-based learning. So then for maybe 15 years, I was deeply involved in working with teachers and academics, particularly mm-hmm. in terms of how to exploit new technologies in learning. And with those new technologies came all sorts of new opportunities for how we support organizations and individuals to do their jobs better, to learn, to get up to speed faster, and all those sorts of things. So I guess that's where that brought my sort of childhood thinking or my thinking and my upbringing into reality. And mm-hmm. from the center that I ran, we rolled out the first multinational online courses in 1984. I was involved in launching the world's first pure online MBA in 1995. So I guess all those early, you know, this is going way back, but all of those early experiences really helped me focus down around thinking about the fact that, well, one insight I had early on was that when you look at how people get better at doing whatever they're doing, usually the closer to the point of use that they learn to do it, in other words, if we can bring learning as close to the point of use as possible, the impact is likely to be greater. And we all know this, because if we learn something and then we have 6 months break and we don't touch it and then we try to implement it, we will have to do some sort of refresher. It's very unlikely that we will remember that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we can bring learning to work, into the workplace, the impact that we're likely to have is much greater. And in fact, there's quite a lot of research around this. IBM Consulting did some very good research about 15 years ago, where they showed exactly this, that on-demand learning has greater potential to realize value than taking people away and putting them through courses and classes and then putting them back into work. And of course, we all know, you know, Tom, you and I probably spend quite a lot of our time dealing with things such as training transfer, the challenge of training transfer. Well, if we can bring learning and work together, training transfer issue just disappears. It's not an issue anymore. Right. Because the training transfer issue is the fact that humans are not designed to remember everything. We all don't have photographic memories. And so, you know, we need to sort of work out how we can weave those together to have greater impact. And for me, that's the abiding principle that I work to. And all the work I've done around 70-20-10 is really around how can we extend the role of L&D to take account of the fact that our job isn't just to develop, design, and deliver courses and programs and e-learning programs. Our job really is to help our organizations as a whole perform better. And that requires more than that 10, more than that formal structured learning. We need to think about all the social aspects of learning. I mean, again, Professor Rob Cross in the US has done a lot of work around social network analysis that shows that the people who are better connected are actually better performers. So all that social element, and then the experiential learning as well. The fact that, you know, no one would ever believe that Serena Williams, for example, doesn't practice and train between each Grand Slam competition. Of course, you know, any top performer in any field understands that practice is critical, except often when we get into our workplace, if we're working in the knowledge industries, we sort of forget that.
Right. So, you know, I'm curious your perspective on, you know, it sounds like some of these ideas go back quite a ways, and yet in the field, you know, many of us are still stuck in this idea that learning's really about, you know, really something that comes before our work or between our work, and we're still kind of struggling to figure out how to integrate it there. What do you see as the big?
I think that's a very good point, Tom. You know, these ideas are not new. They go back a way. I mean, if you think about the idea of the apprentice, you know, going back into the Middle Ages, the idea of the fact that you work with an exemplary performer, you understand the master, what people do. And in fact, when you look at, and the work that we do at the 70-20-10 Institute, a lot of it is based around understanding the critical tasks that exemplary performers execute well, because you will always find the top performers execute a limited number of tasks really well, and that's what makes them top performers. Mm-hmm. And yet when we design learning programs, we often don't think about that. We don't sort of observe, go and get and embed ourselves or understand exactly what exemplary performers do. So these ideas go way back. And I put one of the major challenges that we have down to 18th century Prussia. The concept of the curriculum was developed for the military in the 18th century in Prussia, developed to develop people to fight wars. And that structured curriculum worked really well in 18th century Prussia. It was picked up by an American, taken to the US, and now the world has the concept of a curriculum. And to a certain extent, that limits us, because that immediately puts us into a world where we have a single structure for everyone. So we develop a curriculum. Now, we may be more flexible these days and we have learning paths and things like that, but still based around these principles of a structure. And it also, I think, has taken away a lot of the context. So a lot of what L&D does now is about content. It might be content development or content curation or whatever it is, whereas the real levers for developing high performance and helping people do well is around context, because the context will change. And this is one of the major challenges and one of the major reasons why the link between people performing well, for example, in a training situation, the correlation between that and their performing well in the work situation is often not very high. And that's because of the contextual thing. So, you know, one lesson I've learned is for L&D is to focus more on context rather than on content. You know, content is now a consumable. I've seen so many work with so many organizations who want to build everything themselves because they believe they are special. And when you take a step back or come in from an external perspective, you understand that, of course, there will be sort of slight changes, but actually, you know, every compliance requirement for every organization in financial services will be roughly the same. I mean, of course, there will be some tweaks, or every requirement for across a nation in terms of maybe health and safety will be roughly the same. Of course, there will be, might be some specifics, but getting away from just content to thinking about the context and thinking about the use, that is really critical. How people are going to use this. Is this something I'm doing that is going to be useful to someone at their point of need? And that's the really critical question for me.
Yeah, very interesting. So I'm curious how you see, you know, what is the why here? Why is now different than in the past, where some of these practices were perhaps more effective? What is it about the modern day that's kind of calling for us to make this transition in our roles and in our approach to our work, in our approach to learning? How would you describe that kind of driving reason for this shift?
I think we're in a perfect storm. We're in a perfect storm because the rate of change is increasing. And the speed of change is increasing. Levels of complexity of what pretty well everyone has to deal with is increasing. And again, there's some good research that shows that, you know, a job 20 years ago that might have been or may have been basically a transactional involving transactional work. In other words, someone would learn the rules and then execute those rules. A lot of those jobs have been automated, put into silicon and plastic, and even the same roles today require dealing with ambiguity, decision making, these sorts of things. So we're dealing in an increasingly complex and rapidly changing world, where the winners or the successful organizations and people will be those who can adapt to change. And agility is really critical here in terms of organizations that are agile and can change. And we've got lots of examples of organizations that haven't been able to do that. If you look at the S&P 500 and what that constitutes 30 or 40 years ago, totally different world. And in fact, we now know that since 2009, the value of organizations in the Standard & Poor's 500, more than 80% of that value is in terms of intellectual capital rather than tangible capital. It's intangibles. So it's the value that people bring. It's the intelligence, the inventiveness, the creativeness. So all of those things, I think, are driving us. And one of the challenges that L&D needs to address is how do we as a profession support our organizations in this rapidly changing world? And one very simple practical example is how can we make sure that people understand how we can help them and we can produce solutions or co-create solutions, I would argue, rather than create solutions for them. How can we co-create solutions which are relevant, timely, and deliver value? And the old model of designing, developing, and delivering courses was very slow. It takes time. And often the immediacy, the urgency has passed and people have found other ways to get around it. So L&D, to a certain extent, risks becoming totally irrelevant unless they adopt or unless we adopt sort of new approaches to do this. And we're seeing some good stuff. I mean, we're seeing it in interesting ways. We've seen the rise of what is called micro learning, which is really around micro content. It's nothing to do with micro learning. Micro content, which is one step. It's sort of using existing models and just chopping things up and making it more accessible. That's generally a good thing. I don't think that's the full answer, but it's a good thing. But I think the big changes that are going to occur is when L&D adopts a mindset and develops the capability to develop what I would call performance support approaches. And that could be one of many things. So how can we provide support to people to do their jobs at the point of need? And I've seen some great examples. And at the Institute, we work with organizations that do this. Now, that requires not just new mindsets, but it requires new skills and capabilities for L&D professionals. And there's a lot of work going on there. In fact, I was on a call earlier on this afternoon with the steering group of the UK Learning and Performance Institute, where we've defined a whole new skills and capability matrix for L&D. So there are certainly movements going on and changes occurring around that. So in a way, I think it's a big task, but I think, you know, we will finally get there.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, you mentioned mindset, and I'm curious, you know, kind of in this shift or in this transition that you're describing, and really the focal point of this program is exploring this transition. You know, what would you say are the perhaps the key beliefs or ways of thinking that we as L&D professionals need to let go of, or and as well as the beliefs or ways of thinking that we need to help our stakeholders let go of?
Well, there's one fundamental change that's required, and it was expressed really well to me by a colleague I work with who died 3 years ago called Jay Cross. Now, Jay wrote really an excellent book around informal learning, and Jay often said, we need to be able to separate our thinking about schooling to learning. And he said, Jay would say, one of the major problems that L&D has is that many L&D professionals can't separate schooling from learning. In other words, they think about supporting learning within their organization and we revert to a schooling model of we need to design structure, content, a program of some sort. So we have this program mindset. So for me, the first real change in mindset is to move away from the program mindset. The second change is actually to move away from the learning mindset. I think the learning mindset really inhibits people. And we do a lot of work at the 70-20-10 Institute. In fact, my colleague Jos Aritz is just putting the finishing touches to a book around new business models for learning and development. And that's built around a four-box grid, moving from the learning on the left-hand side to performance on the right-hand side, and moving from the sort of the HR type learning role into the business focused learning role. And in these four boxes, we have what we call order takers. And all of us have to do some order taking, because if we are required to, for example, support compliance in the organization, you know, that's an order taking. We just have to design that to make sure it's done. Mm-hmm. Moving up to, if you think of the box on the top left-hand side, to a learning enabler, how do we enable and support people to learn more and to learn faster and to respond better in organizations? And that's all well and good. And many organizations, L&D professionals, are up in that top left-hand corner. Then if you move to the right-hand side, which is all about performance, and this is the big change that L&D really needs to take in terms of mindset, and that is, the performance enabler is not focused on learning, but is focused on performance. It's not about how much knowledge and skills do people need to have, but actually what can they do? Mm-hmm. So this is sort of speaks to the knowing doing gap. How do we make sure that we're focused on helping people do rather than helping people know? And that performance enabler, and then moving to the top right hand side of the quadrant of the grid, which is really around the value creation. That's around, how do we change our mindset to focus on how can we become critical elements in creating value in our organization? And moving from the left to the right-hand side, from the learning to the performance, also means that almost inevitably, L&D departments move from being cost centers to being value creators. Mm-hmm. So moving from a world where, you know, when there's a trim of budgets, people will look at the L&D department and say, well, maybe we can restructure or change it in some way because it's a cost, to moving to being an integral part of creating value in the organization, where L&D is called in at the beginning of projects to make sure that their expertise is added to the pool of delivering whatever it is to be delivered. So I think, mm-hmm. in terms of mindset, there's that. And it feeds back to what I said earlier in terms of L&D needs to move from a mindset of thinking about content to context, or from content to experience, I guess. Mm-hmm. So designing and supporting experiences which provide learning, rather than thinking about just developing the content. The other mindset change really, I think, is it's around making sure that L&D sees themselves as a contributor to the whole, thinking in terms of, if you're going to measure what you're doing, there are really no L&D metrics that are any use to anyone outside of an L&D department. And I often get this question asked about, how do we measure what we're doing? How do you measure informal learning? How do you measure the 70 and the 20, for example? And the answer is, well, exactly the same way as you measure formal structured learning, you use stakeholder metrics. So if, for example, you're working with a customer service part of the organization, for example, you want to improve customer service, what metrics do you use? Well, you use CSAT, you use customer satisfaction metrics. Mm-hmm. If you're working with the sales part of an organization, what metrics do you use? Well, you measure maybe sales volume or margins or some metric which is being cost of sales or whatever is being used by the sales part of the organization. If you're looking to improve process within the organization, you would use metrics that are used in terms of to measure process improvement. So the idea of using learning measures for that is sort of a mismatch, I think. So in terms of mindset, people working in L&D need to start to think like their customers, there are the internal clients, to think about what problem it is that they're looking to solve, and then co-create. And again, I think that's another key element in terms of, we don't do learning for our clients, our customers. We have to actually create solutions, co-create solutions with them.
Yeah. So you've mentioned this kind of emerging role where L&D is a bit more, a bit more of an integral role, a more strategic role within the organization, perhaps more involved in these strategic conversations. You know, what advice would you have for L&D professionals that are aware of this and perhaps, you know, coming up against challenges in participating in that way within their organizations? What can we do to grow into these types of roles, to communicate the need for this within our organizations, and you know, what, for example, just imagine, you know, if you were kind of back in that type of situation, maybe in the earlier part of your career and facing that challenge, what do you think you would be focused on right now in that type of role?
I would be focused on making sure I spoke the language of my clients. So if I were working in, for example, a government department, I would know exactly what the leaders in my organization were expecting, what they were challenged with, and would speak their language. No one wants to sit in a meeting and hear the word pedagogy or some sort of learning centric. So start to speak the language of business. But also, just in practical terms, my experience is that getting involved and delivering quickly, delivering at speed, even if it's just small bits, so running pilots, proofs of concept, are really, really powerful. I can give you an example. When I was chief learning officer at Reuters, we had a major challenge in terms of developing technical capability, because Reuters at that time had 5,000 software developers and database managers, and running them through standard training programs for, you know, the Microsoft and Cisco and so on certifications was just not delivering performance overall, improving overall performance. Mm-hmm. So we decided to pilot a just-in-time service with a set of online books and reference material, and we gathered data around the use of that over a period of months. So just a 3-month block where we rolled it out to, I think, to about 1,250 people across the world, and then we measured the usage, and then we talked to people who were using this and asked them questions such as, having access to these resources rather than attending courses, how much time do you think it's saving? And the answer came back, it was a small amount. I think the figure was 4.8 hours a week or something like that. But when we factored it up, we found that very quickly we produced an extremely good business case that, in terms of productivity increases, time to desk, all sorts of factors, it was really clear we had the data to be able to demonstrate to the key stakeholders that this was the way to go. And it had huge impact. Overall, it reduced costs. We didn't intend it to reduce costs, but it reduced the cost base. It increased the overall performance and contributed manifestly to the organization, so much so that the business head of technology and operations at Reuters called me into his office with his finance guy and simply handed his entire budget to me for developing his people so that we could do, you know, because there was that confidence that we could do a good job. Now, it's not going to happen like that every time, but making sure that we get close to our clients, speak their language, and carry out short proofs of concept and pilots to prove and to refine what we do is really critical, rather than stepping back, going into our black box and producing the full final solutions, the courses and programs and so on with the bows on top, without having really worked closely with our internal or our external clients. Critical.
Okay, I know, Charles, that you are doing some great work in this space, supporting organizations, supporting L&D professionals to, you know, better understand this, build their skills, build their knowledge, make this type of transition. Is there anything specific you'd like to share today with our audience about how they can follow up with your work? I know probably the majority of them are already familiar with your work on some level. But would you like to share anything specific you'd like for them to check out, or?
Oh, sure. Next steps? Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm on Twitter at Charles Jennings. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on all the social media channels, so you can always find me there. Happy to engage with people, and of course, the work that we do at the 70-20-10 Institute, and you can get to that just by going to 70-20-10institute.com, is we've got quite a lot of white papers, and we have case studies with companies like Citibank and various others that you can download and see what we've been doing there in terms of really helping to use that 70-20-10 model, which we call a performance model. It's not a learning model. It's not about learning. It's about how we can help organizations improve performance by extending beyond the formal programs into solving problems actually beyond simply knowledge and skills issues into how do we help our organizations improve their processes, how do we fix some of the environmental factors. So there's lots of material there. So and we produce white papers. We work with the Institute. We have various organizations who are partners of ours, business partners, some learning tech companies and various others. And we often publish papers in conjunction with them. So keep an eye out for those. You'll always see them flagged up on Twitter from the Institute Twitter account or from my Twitter account or one of my colleagues' Twitter accounts.
Great. And just for our audience, I'll have some links to some of these things you've mentioned in the show notes. So be sure to check those out. And on behalf of our listeners and myself, thank you very much, Charles, for your time today. I know you're a busy man and I want to respect your time. I really appreciate your willingness to come on the program and share your experience and your perspective. Very valuable for me personally, very valuable, I'm sure, for our listeners. So thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
And thanks very much to all you listening. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to resources and follow the show for more insights and advice from leaders in the field of L&D. You can also find more free resources at wiredroots.org. Again, I'm Tom Palmer, signing off for now, and until next time, may the force of learning be with you.